Да. Это одежда, в которой Стив рисует. Он рисует. Мы застали его в творческой такой обстановке. А говорить мы будем про сапплименты и вот эти дела. Окей, Стив, would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Steve Fowkes. I'm a United States citizen, and I have been studying nutrition for many, many years. My academic training is in organic chemistry, and I went from that into biochemistry and into chemistry of aging and neurodegenerative diseases. My grandfather passed from when I was in college from Alzheimer's disease and complications from emphysema. And so it's been a lifelong quest of mine, even though I did most of my work in not other fields, but to study aging and to study how the mind and neurodegenerative diseases actually function in a developmental manner. And about 15 years ago, there was some seminal research that led to basically a way to reverse Alzheimer's disease. And about 5 years ago, this was replicated by a mainstream medical team at the Buck Institute and at the University of California at Los Angeles. And so now I'm actually working on reversing cases of Alzheimer's disease.
So it is reversible.
It is totally reversible, 90% reversible by current technologies.
Does it depend on which stage of Alzheimer's you started?
Well, that was the assumption.
Prevention is important.
People thought that, you know, people who had severe Alzheimer's and for a long period of time would be very difficult to reverse. It's not the case.
But how many people altogether already went through reversal?
In my situation with the people I've worked with, it's about six. And with the Dale Bredesen and his team, it's hundreds.
So professionally, you are
Scientific consultant to a medical team. So I'm not licensed, I'm not a medical practitioner, it's not like I represent myself that way, but I'm knowledgeable about the emerging scientific literature. I'm knowledgeable about things that will become medical practice in 5 or 15 years.
And you mentioned before that you are authoring a newsletter?
I've done two newsletters. I've written six books as either author or co-author. So I love to write, and I also hate to write.
But what are the subjects?
One of them had to do with Chinese proverbs, and five of them are about nutrition.
Okay, so if we have relatively a brief conversation with people who live in Russia, coming to nutrition, is there any message which you really are passionate to deliver? So say, guys, that is important. Nobody cares. Nobody pays attention. But that is a life-changing thing.
Well, reversing Alzheimer's disease is that.
Okay.
But there are other things that I've discovered. You know, men, for example, often don't manage their iron properly, and they end up with iron toxicity. And this is a catastrophic problem, and it's very inexpensive to test, but it's just not tested very often. The mental retardation and disabilities associated with children with Down syndrome.
Yes.
Parents are told that their kids are born retarded. It's not true. They become retarded if you don't treat it. They become retarded between birth and 2 years of age. That's when the human brain is doing all kinds of pruning and fine-tuning. And if you prevent that over-pruning of the nervous system, the Down syndrome children have 85% of their mental retardation stopped.
But you're talking about preventing that by
nutrition.
Nutrition overall, or you just mentioned iron?
Well, iron is a critical issue in the management of Down syndrome brain issues, but selenium is really the critical one. If you look at infant formulas, you're going to find all of them have iron in them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody, all the pediatricians know that iron deficiency is really serious for children, developing children. Okay. But none of them really realize that selenium is critical for babies with Down syndrome.
But then pharmaceutical companies and baby food companies, says they don't know?
Well, there's one company that in the United States, it's an FDA-approved infant formula laboratory mm-hmm. that's making a formulation for Down syndrome babies and children. Mm-hmm. So you can buy it. But you have to know to ask for it. You have to know where to go to get it. So if you have a child with Down syndrome, mm-hmm. you're told there's nothing you can do. Your child is born retarded. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, treat them as well as you can mm-hmm. and enjoy them as much mm-hmm. as you can. Mm-hmm. They're never going to be, you know, smart in all of this. But there's one Down syndrome, a woman with Down syndrome mm-hmm. who is as smart as I am mm-hmm. and became a veterinarian.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
She would have been a doctor, but nobody would accept her mm-hmm. as a doctor.
Mm-hmm. If you look at,
but the animals don't care.
Yeah.
if you look at younger people, let's say in their 20s, okay, should they be kind of aware of any supplements which they have to take, or they are too young to really focus on that?
Well, for neurodegenerative diseases, yes, they're too young.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of stuff that's going on in our modern society that people should know about.
Uh-huh.
You know, genetically modified organisms, for example, are a serious health risk by amplifying the inflammatory effects of foods.
You mean the food we consume?
Well, if it's genetically engineered,
yes.
it's more inflammatory than it's not.
Uh-huh.
So if you have something that's a native uh-huh. corn, it has a certain level of inflammation, and then you have genetically bred corn, which is more inflammatory, mm-hmm. than you have GMO corn, which is highly inflammatory.
But so that is scientifically proven.
Yes.
So it is
But the companies that sell the corn deny it all. And various government people, mm-hmm. because they're promoting this as a way to save people's lives, you can grow more food if it's genetically engineered, they're promoting it as a way to solve hunger and starvation. So it's politically incorrect to talk about.
But they promote it with the knowledge of those things being inflammatory and somehow impacting the people's health, or they just deny it, or they say it's not proven. I mean, what is the discussion?
I would say that they would say that they think it's not inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
So they look at it as, there's certain barriers you need to get the product into the marketplace,
yes.
and they've done that, and that all these people who are saying all these bad things about their product are just doing so out of ignorance and fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they would say.
Okay, yeah.
I want to ask you, because, you know, I'm more on the practical side rather than on the scientific side, but you mentioned, like, two levels of genetically modified products, and when I looked on the products in the store, it says no GMO. Does it mean that it's not totally modified, or so it's pure, or it's one of the levels? So what should we look for?
Well, there's two different kinds of genetic enhancements.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is plant breeding.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing that for probably 30,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
As long as there have been people living in city states that are growing food and raising animals, we've been breeding plants
yeah.
and crossing them, you know, cross-fertilizing them and doing strains. And
mm-hmm.
and the same way we've bred dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we start off with wolves and we then modify them and interbreed them and select for characteristics. And now we have dogs
mm-hmm.
that can actually eat human food, whereas
mm-hmm.
a wolf can't eat human food.
Okay,
so we've done that kind of thing. We've done it with plants. So most of the plants that we eat nowadays are not wild.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the plants that our ancestors from, you know, 100 generations ago started to grow and eat. They're modified in a variety of ways, but that's a very slow process, and it's mild. It's hard to really hurt the food that way,
mm-hmm.
in a way that is catastrophic.
Okay.
But now, all of a sudden, with genetic modifications directly, we're now creating what would be called Frankenstein foods that are dramatically different in serious ways that would have taken, you know, generations of time in the past can now be done in a few weeks.
So it might damage the kind of planet health dramatically, and We pretty much know it's going to happen.
It could, and it can hurt people, and it can hurt animals. Mm-hmm. So there were actually situations where animals would forage on genetically modified corn after the corn had been harvested for people. The animals would forage on it and then die because it was that inflammatory in their gut. And who knows the exact mechanism of how that happened, but it's a warning flag that, you know, when animals eat something like that and they die, that's a message to us. We should be paying attention
but
to this.
On the other hand, if you think about how big the population is of the planet and how much natural food we can actually produce, so definitely we cannot do it. I mean, we have to go for modification for something which is more productive. Otherwise, we have to just kind of bring the population down. Yeah?
Well, that's not going to happen. Okay. Anybody who says that we need to bring the population down doesn't have a mechanism of doing it that's humane.
Yeah.
Because,
yes,
you know, my opinion is that the best way to lower population, mm-hmm, is to make people affluent, but that puts a bigger strain on the planet. But at least people have fewer kids when they're,
yes,
affluent.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea that's the argument that we need to feed all these people who are poor, mm-hmm, and that raising the productivity of the land is an important aspect of it.
Yes.
So we need to have, you know, Roundup ready produce, and we need to have monoculture farms and stuff. And yet there are people who are doing pilot work with, you know, mixed growth beds and naturally fertilized soils and stuff, where they're using organic methods, who have increased the productivity beyond what can be achieved with these genetically modified organisms. So
Okay. It's
not that argument is compelling from an ideological point of view, but from a practical point of view, it can be questioned. Well, it's also the case that when you look at the amount of food that's grown and the amount of food that's wasted, there's already enough food on the planet to feed everybody.
Okay.
It's not a food production problem, it's a food distribution problem.
Yeah. Commercial aspects.
Commercial and political.
Okay.
So there are many places where food has been sent in to people who are starving to death, and it's intercepted by their local government and distributed for their purposes instead of going to the people who are starving to death.
And there is lots of food we destroy just to keep the market price.
That's right.
Certain
and
level.
Also to keep people out of certain areas. So, for example, restaurants usually throw away enough food to feed, you know, as many customers that they have during the day, mm-hmm, as paying customers. They throw enough food to feed an equal number of people. They throw it away,
mm-hmm,
and local zoning and regulations prevent them from giving it to the poor and the hungry.
Sure.
Oh, wow.
Sure. Well, otherwise the area will be flooded with undesirable people.
That's right. Yeah. They'll all come into the urban areas,
yes,
and the ruin your neighborhoods,
absolutely,
and your property values will go,
absolutely,
down.
Yeah.
And on and
no,
on.
No, but
on
it would be a very civil way of distribution, say, to give it to some locations, to the specific locations, so not just give it away on the street. It could be managed.
Yeah. So Trader Joe's does that for food that's expired and stuff, and they have ways that they donate that,
yeah,
to,
yeah,
like the Second Harvest Food Bank.
Canada,
and stuff.
Many places, yeah.
There are many places. Which,
food banks.
Yeah, food banks which could be done. You know, it's funny enough, like, maybe like a week ago, I saw the ad on the store, or it was in the magazine in the store, because it says that people, you should switch from eating meat to eat more almonds and stuff and some nuts, because the planet is just lack of real meat, so we have to switch in our mind and consume more nuts rather than real meat.
That's right, and that's a very bad idea. I mean, ecologically, it makes a lot of sense that it takes less water and less,
exactly,
sunlight to, mm-hmm, raise a calorie of a nut than it does for meat. But the problem is that nuts have adverse health consequences that meat doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Well, for example, polyunsaturated fatty acids. They're carcinogenic.
Mm. Okay.
This is not really appreciated by most people, but the polyunsaturated fatty acids, it's kind of like you have the cure of the day, the cure, you know, in terms of fads, the cure of the day, the cure of the week, the cure of the month, the cure of the year, mm-hmm, the cure of the decade. Well, Polyunsaturated fatty acids is one of those cures of the decades. Everybody's on the bandwagon. Fish oil, mm-hmm. and maybe flax oil, and even primrose oil, and you know these kinds of polyunsaturated mm-hmm. fats. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that they're easily peroxidizable. When they go rancid, they're carcinogens, they're mutagens, they're teratogens. They give you cancer. They cause birth defects. And eating a higher amount of those exposes us to risk, yeah. and that risk is proportional to age. It goes up exponentially with age, and this is one of the things that was found in that the United States' folly of the prudent diet, mm-hmm. where you should stop eating animal fat and mm-hmm. eat vegetable fat. Mm-hmm. Well, initially, it looked like there were benefits from that, mm-hmm. but after 20 to 30 years, they're now finding that cancer rates in the people who eat animal fat versus vegetable fat, and the vegetable fat, it's 8 times higher.
Oh, wow.
8 times higher. And they didn't see it up front because the population of people that they were studying was younger. Mm-hmm. But as these people age and got up into their 60s, 70s, and 80s, all of a sudden they're seeing these statistics that show this, and it can't be published in the mainline journals. Mm-hmm. New England Journal of Medicine won't touch it.
Yes.
The original initial studies were in the New England Journal of mm-hmm. Medicine, but now that these new findings contradict it, they're not willing to publish.
I've heard that in India, for example, with lots of vegetarians, many vegetarians there, so their cancer rate is much higher than in any other country.
Well,
because of that, maybe.
Vegetables have a big advantage. So even if you're eating meat, for most people, that you should be eating huge amounts of vegetables with the meat. Mm-hmm. The issue is, you know, how much meat should you be eating? And I think that the whole vegan idea or of no meat at all is really wrong. Mm-hmm. And that in India, where this, they point at India and say, well, look at this as a relatively healthy population mm-hmm. of people who are a lot of total vegetarians or total vegans, and look how healthy they are. Well, it's actually, they're not total vegans because their grain mm-hmm. has insect parts in it, which is meat. Mm-hmm. We don't think about it that way, but it is. That gives you all those kinds of meat-related nutrients like nucleic acids and B12 and things like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the United States, our government protects us from insect parts in the grain. So American vegetarians don't get insect parts along with their vegan foods and grain foods. So there's a lot of subtleties that are involved in research that aren't really appreciated when the findings come out, and each side of an argument, you know, when they look at the same kind of data, they see different things and come to different conclusions because they're cherry picking the data to match their preconceived conclusions.
Well, and we are talking about trillions of dollars, not even billions. I mean, the food industry is like $2-3 trillion dollars industry.
It's huge.
It's better.
You know, right now last year we are really watching what we eat, and we were told that eating monosaturated fats is much better than polysaturated fats. But the problem is the definition of monosaturated fats and polysaturated fats varies from one person to another one. So I am still confused for which oil is considered to be monosaturated versus polysaturated. And they
all have a blend. I mean, the oil is not only genetically influenced by the plant, but it's also environmentally influenced. And so the further north your plant grows, the more polyunsaturated fatty acids it has in it. And also in terms of fish, mm-hmm. you catch a trout in Mexico, it's got lower polyunsaturates than a trout caught in the Rocky Mountains.
Wow. And we were told to eat only north catching
cold water fish. That's the thing that they say, cold water fish.
Exactly. Yes.
And it's the same species, can be in warm water
yes.
and cold water,
yes.
but it's the cold water fish that has the highest polyunsaturate content.
God.
Okay.
Wow.
And the same thing with seeds. Seeds, the more northern the seed is uh-huh. in terms of its location, the more polyunsaturated it has in the seed because the germination period and the growth period are so short. The mm-hmm. further north you go, mm-hmm. the less time a plant has to, mm-hmm. to go from a seed to a full plant and then drop the new seeds for the next
right.
year.
So
and the more polyunsaturated it is, the faster it germinates.
I understand.
The more suddenly it germinates.
So if you're talking about coconut oil, because it's a tropical fruit, so it's really good one, right?
It's my opinion. It's my fat staple. It's
yeah,
coconut
and
oil.
That's what we used also. And what do you say about, you know, sometimes ago in Costco they sold combination sunflower combination with coconut oil. And I found for myself that when you really do frying, the temperature is, you know, it sustained high temperature. So it's among all other kind of oils, it's a good one.
For cooking. But
for cooking,
well,
yeah.
I don't think any polyunsaturated oil should be used for frying.
But it's a combination. What about
I don't think it matters.
Sunflower? Is this a
no polyunsaturated oil should ever be fried with
no,
it.
No, but the sunflower, is this polyunsaturated?
It's polyunsaturated.
Oh,
it's
okay.
polyunsaturated,
okay.
yes. Sunflower.
Okay,
so olive oil is probably the biggest monounsaturated fat, and I think cooking with that is fine because a single double bond doesn't peroxidize that readily.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you have two
mm-hmm.
that are right next to each other,
mm-hmm.
that site in between those two double bonds
mm-hmm.
that is susceptible to peroxidation
mm-hmm.
and heat and oxygen and light
Converted
are all catalysts
light.
For mm-hmm. driving that rancidity process
mm-hmm.
so my feeling is if you're going to fry it should be in saturated fat
what do you say
and monounsaturated
what do you
fat.
Say about G oil G fat
G
yeah
oh ghee.
Ghee.
Okay. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to
do. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, butter, it's got a small amount of unsaturated fat in it, but it's also, because it's most of the time it's raw, you shouldn't fry in it, but ghee is clarified, so you can fry in it.
So it's good for women for frying?
It's better than corn oil and safflower oil.
Oh, yes.
And
those, no, we don't use those at all.
Coming back to fish, we were told that the preferred fish is first coming out of cold water and second being small rather than big.
Yes.
The size. So how is
that? Well, it's also whether it's at the top of the food chain or at the bottom of the food chain. As you go up the food chain, the toxins like polychlorinated biphenyls and heavy metals
mm-hmm.
accumulate.
Okay.
So a small animal will eat it and have a certain amount, and then a bigger animal eats that one, and a bigger animal eats that one. And as you go up that chain,
mm-hmm.
all those things get concentrated in the fat.
Mm.
So that's eating at the bottom of the food chain with things like, let's say, sardines
mm-hmm.
is better than eating at the top of the chain like, let's say, swordfish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let's say salmon... even being big is okay? Or
well, it's also whether or not it's farmed
yes.
or it's wild.
Okay, if it is farmed, what happens?
Well, all of the feed that you feed the fish and all the environment, the messy environment, makes the fish more toxic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but you get more pounds per area and it's less expensive to
mm-hmm.
farm fish.
Okay.
When they said that they do not fish, say, salmons with antibiotics, like you can buy in the Whole Foods or Costco, they said no antibiotics. Is that true or is it just a false statement?
I know that the various claims have been proven to be false, but whether a specific claim is false or not, I don't really know.
But how would they apply antibiotics to fish?
Put it in the feed, in the water? Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you have an aquarium, you've got methylene blue that
yeah.
you put in the aquarium to keep your fish healthy.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I take it as a dietary supplement.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for a good advice which we can give to people. And I'm thinking, well, probably each person should think about his own supplements, but... as an overall idea of being good with supplements, what would you suggest?
Oh, it's like clothing. It's what supplements are good for you depend upon your genetics, your epigenetics, your constitution, and your lifestyle, and all of that is different for different people. So if you go to the store and you want to buy clothes, you know, and you, what do? You try them on and you look at yourself in the mirror.
But you look
people
at,
should do that.
You look in the mirror, and even if you look ugly to other people, but you like it anyway, and you buy it, and you are fine. If you do that with foods, with supplements, and whatever, so it might negatively impact your health condition. So
it could. Yes.
But as a reasonable person who doesn't have reasonably prudent person who has no time really to become a doctor. What is the way to go?
Well, the only way to go, I think, is biohacking, where you have some way of quantifying the benefits and harms that get done to you.
But do you think that the people should do some blood tests before taking any supplements, or this could be done by aging, like say for us? We use ton of those, and we don't know for sure if this is good and bad.
to say that, it's not like I want to say that blood tests are useless. They're not. They're not useless at all. There's all kinds of really great ways to assess different things, to know what kinds of nutritional requirements you have or what kinds of dysbiosis you have in your gut and things like that. But medical testing is typically very expensive. And for most people, they don't have that kind of resource to invest in that kind of approach to things. So they're making their decisions based on how they feel and how well they do at work and how they wake up in the morning and whether or not they have a good sex life and those kinds of subjective value, value-based decisions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's all absolutely valid, because values are what your values are, mm-hmm. and they're not something that somebody else tells you or sets for you.
But yeah, but then let's say someone has an issue, okay, whatever, a noticeable issue, and maybe it might be handled by using some supplement. And I have no idea. Maybe I have to go to doctor and get a pill or a shot, or maybe shoot myself. I don't know. But somehow I'm not competent. What should I do?
Well, the medical professionals that you deal with, they're also not competent.
Okay.
Exactly.
So the point is that you've got people who are ignorant on both sides of it. Even though we look at somebody in a white lab coat with a stethoscope draped around their neck as being a sign of knowledge, it's very specific knowledge.
Okay.
And when you talk about nutrition, the average person with a white stethoscope, with a white lab coat and stethoscope draped around their neck, they've had anywhere from one day of nutrition education during their career to as much as maybe a month of it. And you can't learn. As somebody who's studied nutrition for decades, you can't become competent with that level of knowledge.
But some people are nutritionists just limiting their expertise to nutrition.
And they make bad decisions as well.
Okay.
So, for example, the prudent diet. This is a big thing that's been promoted in the United States for four decades, and it's totally wrong.
Okay.
And millions of people have been hurt by it.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 million people have died prematurely because of it.
Wow.
And that's official government policy supported by scientists.
What was the diet specifically?
It's called the prudent diet, which was to substitute vegetable fat for animal fat.
Oh, okay.
Vegetarian or
Yes. And it's all based on faulty research, selective research, cherry-picked research, and political influence.
But cherry-picked research is basically fraud. I mean, if you ignore specific knowledge, which is material to the case, it's a fraud.
Yeah. So, parents with children with Down syndrome are told their children are retarded. It's not true. It's a lie.
Okay.
But that's the official policy.
Okay.
So there's no guarantee that just because somebody has a credential on their wall that they're going to know what they need to know for you or you in terms of your health issues.
But
with doctors, they try on, they say, okay, you're depressed. Let's give you this antidepressant. Yeah. Okay, that one didn't work. Let's give you this one. It's intrinsically experimental. Whether you experiment on your own or they experiment with you, the idea is that having a doctor experiment with you is low risk, and having doing it on yourself is high risk. That's what we're told.
Yeah.
And the fact is that the data doesn't support that.
Okay.
The largest cause of death in the United States today is iatrogenesis, which is doctor-induced death, doctor-mediated death. It's more than heart disease, and it's more than cancer. The statistics are that, official statistics are that it's like third. Mm-hmm. Third cause of death. Third most popular
That's
cause
what
of death.
Feel by
but
ourselves.
It's also seriously underreported.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, it's like heart disease, you know, considering that is like the number one or number two killer, mm-hmm. when really almost everybody who dies of heart disease has kidney failure underneath it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so you could say that realistically, kidney failure is the number one cause of disease because mm-hmm. everybody who dies of heart disease, 90% of them have kidney failure that actually causes them to die.
One more question about reversibility of certain things. Diabetes.
It's reversible.
I mean, 100%, 90%, 60%.
At least 90.
You mean type 2?
Type 2.
Is
type 1 has been reversed as well, but it's much more highly controversial, and that goes into the whole issue of autoimmune disease. And it's of my opinion that autoimmune disease could be, mm-hmm. you know, way better than 50% reversible.
But coming back to type 2, reversibility comes out of just changing the lifestyle, or it's about some medication which can reverse it, or what?
Both. Yeah. But mainly it's lifestyle. So there's two diets that can reverse type 2 diabetes with some high degree of reliability.
Okay.
One is a raw vegan diet, and the other is a paleo diet.
Okay.
So moderate fat, low carb, restricted carbohydrate diet.
So there is a proven kind of track of that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So what do they have in common? I mean, they look ideologically as polar opposites.
Okay.
You know, animal fat and vegetables versus nothing but raw vegetables and no mm-hmm. animal products at all. Mm-hmm. Both of them reverse the diabetes. And what they have in common is that they both induce ketosis.
Okay.
They both induce fat burning, which then is an antidote to the problem with the carbohydrate burning that doesn't work because of the insulin resistance and the insulin problem.
But you said, actually, I have a bunch of questions. So the keto diet, in the long term, I know that you cannot stay for this like not without any interruptions, but still, with those periods, if you keep along this keto diet for a long time, is it good for people or it's still bad? Because I know that people that consume so much fat,
regardless of
diabetes, they consume so much fat and the animals products, blah blah blah, no carbs at all. And on the long term run, is it good or bad?
Well, I think that that's not an answered question. Now, we don't have the same kind of focus on what would happen for somebody who's in ketosis 99% of the time. So I don't recommend it. I suggest that people, even let's say somebody who's the most suited for a ketogenic diet, would be somebody with, let's say, cancer.
Okay.
That even those people should be in ketosis only 6.5 days out of every 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
So once a week, they should break their ketosis and go back into carb burning mode, and then immediately the next day flip back into ketosis again.
Mm-hmm.
Because humans are made to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Our distant ancestors had times when there was massive amounts of food and we feasted, mm-hmm. and then there were times when we starved.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back and forth between those states. Anytime we were in a valley and we used up all the food, we would then go for without food while we were hiking to the next valley. We were nomadic and we were moving from food source to food source to food source.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we found food, we gorged, and when we didn't, we didn't. We starved.
Mm-hmm.
And that every time we would starve, we would go into ketosis. So that's part of an ancient lifestyle, an ancestor lifestyle that we don't do anymore because we've got our supermarkets and we've got our grain and we've got 24/7, 365 availability of food.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what people are now realizing as a viable strategy is the concept of intermittent things,
mm-hmm.
intermittent fasting, intermittent diets, carb-restricted diets, fat-restricted diets, protein-restricted diets, where you do this on an engineering basis to mimic what our distant ancestors did.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we are trying. We are on the program for 4 weeks trying to find a candida. And so we are taking the natural remedy medication. I forgot about
what
the name.
Remedy?
So we are 4 weeks on a very restricted carbohydrates diet. So we only eat a small amount of grain in the morning, and basically that's it for the whole day in terms of the carbohydrates. And
why do you eat grain instead of, let's say, yam?
Yum. Because we were suggested to eat black...
you mean black?
Гречку, как она...
Buckwheat?
Buckwheat, yes.
Buckwheat.
This is the, because we did a lot of testing what our body can consume and what it cannot. And so among, this is also tradition, the country we came from, so we do not eat cereal, we eat what's called kashas, right?
Okay.
And buckwheat is the one grain that is very good consumed in our body, so this
okay.
is our personal...
Well, that is a problem, though, in terms of when you look at foods and you categorize them in terms of their inflammatory risk.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
You have two different things. One is an intrinsic inflammatory nature of the food itself.
Mm-hmm.
What,
yes.
is, what kinds of phytochemicals does it have
yes.
that are designed to keep animals from eating it?
Mm-hmm.
But the other one is having to do with individual tolerances for
exactly.
things. And many foods that
yeah.
Are relatively benign, if you eat them all the time,
mm-hmm.
you become allergic to them because
yes,
you're
exactly.
sensitizing your
yes.
immune system again and again and again. And eventually the immune system goes, this is not good, this is bad. And it loses track of the ability to turn on and turn off the immune system.
Okay.
This is part of the problem with autoimmune disease, is that the basis of the immune system for turning off and turning off gets overwhelmed, and it loses the distinction of being the turning off part of the process,
mm-hmm.
it loses the ability to do that.
Oh, well, actually, but, we have...
But
like,
coming back to your diet, what was the question?
Yeah, the question was that for 4 weeks, we only consume very small amount of carbohydrates. Right now, just don't just pay attention to what kind of carbohydrates it is. Just very small amount. So for 4 weeks, we're out of it because we're taking medication. We eat a lot of fermented food and we eat a lot of probiotics to get rid of candida.
Mm-hmm.
And so these 4 weeks, we are pretty much, I'm not sure if this is not keto because we still eat some carbohydrates, but how bad it is for the health to be all 4 weeks without any fruit, anything that has sweets on it, to just get rid of this
candida.
Well, in a sense, you're not getting rid of it.
Absolutely, yes, but at
yeah.
least we can bring down the amount.
You bring down the amount.
And make the balance.
And you can possibly restore the way in which your candida is managed in your gut and by your immune system.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the idea.
We were told we have, probably most likely, we have the leaking gut issue and...
Yeah, but do you know any evidence?
And there's a balance between, in the gut, you've got three different populations that are all fighting it out.
Okay.
And you've got bacteria versus fungus.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way you fight candida as a fungus is that
mm-hmm.
you strengthen your bacteria.
Bacteria.
And you're
yes.
taking bacterial probiotics.
Yeah,
yes.
that's what
well,
we do.
Bacteria also have bacteriophages
yes.
that keep them under control.
Okay.
So these are... viruses that prey only on bacteriophages and don't prey on the human, but they just prey on the bacteriophages and they don't prey on the fungus.
Okay.
And then you have the fungus itself, which is, when you look at it as a population, you've got funguses that are fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way that you can fight candida is to eat fermented foods with other kinds of fungus in it, or to take a probiotic like Saccharomyces boulardii, which is supposedly a beneficial form of fungus that, you know, takes the battle into that fungal realm.
Mm-hmm.
But fungus likes aerobic environments, and viruses and bacteria like anaerobic environments. And so it's part of the problem that people have is that as we age, our entire constitution is shifting into a more aerobic phase.
Okay.
We lose that, our antioxidant capacities that that babies and teenagers have with
mm-hmm.
their hormones and their vast metabolisms, where they think they're immortal and they can eat anything with impunity because they don't see the negative effects of,
okay.
of bad eating habits.
Mm-hmm.
But as we get older and older, our metabolism is slowly dropping over time, and we lose about 0.33% per year on average over this period of time. And so eventually we get down to the point that energy isn't enough to maintain our antioxidant defense system
mm-hmm.
as robustly as it should be.
Okay.
And at that point, we have a higher risk of autoimmune disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if somebody goes through diabetes earlier in that process,
mm-hmm.
their metabolism crashes, now they have autoimmune disease early in life instead.
Okay.
And that's why women have a lot of autoimmune disease when they're young, is because that estrogen influence in the teen years drops their metabolism early in life. Men have this higher metabolism and it drops slowly. So for men, it's this gradual decline where autoimmune disease gets more and more and more and more advanced. But in women, there's this drop early, and then there's this sustainability of metabolism during the entire menstrual cycle. And women don't age very much during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the benefits of having this cycling going on, is mm-hmm. it stabilizes women against aging
okay.
and allows them to be fertile and have a lot of kids during that period of time.
Okay.
And then when they go through menopause, mm-hmm. boom, the metabolism mm-hmm. drops again, and all of a sudden all kinds of autoimmune disease risks and cardiovascular disease risks and stuff go up again
mm-hmm.
because their metabolism has dropped. So we have all this knowledge to know about how metabolism relates to degenerative diseases, but it's not used in mainstream medicine. If somebody's got a problem, they're not assessed for their metabolic rate,
absolutely.
Other than to look at thyroid hormone levels.
I talked to my doctor, and so I have type 2 diabetes, and at some point I found out that just being on a reasonable diet would prevent me from diabetes and cholesterol issues and all that stuff. And I said, why? He says, it's obvious. I'm saying, wait a second, if it is that obvious, why I was always getting pills instead of a diet? He says, Michael, diet is not practical. Pill is a practical. So, but that, who is going to stay on a diet? But pill is practical.
Yeah, it's true. That's how lazy humans are nowadays. They'd rather take a pill a day at an investment of 5 seconds out of their life
mm-hmm.
than to alter their habits.
I have a question. Like, if you see the person, somebody came for you for a consultation, and you see the person the very first time, so you don't know the test, you don't know anything. So what would be approach to actually suggest something to this particular individual? So how would you approach without knowing much about this person? You said this is very individual, how you select the supplements. But if you don't know about the person, do you subscribe them to suggest them to take some blood test before you make some suggestions? So how would you decide what
yes,
is good?
Yes, I do. And it's a stepwise process. And for me, I don't, even though I have an intuitive nature, it's not related to health.
Mm-hmm.
So if I meet somebody,
mm-hmm.
I can't tell what their health issues are just by looking at them,
okay.
just by feeling them, just by grokking them. But there are medical intuitives who can do that,
mm-hmm.
and I don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So my approach is rational.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about things. So what I do is I have a conversation with them,
mm-hmm.
and I ask them about their health complaints, and I ask them about symptoms, and I ask them about their past, and I ask them about traumas in their life, and I ask them about all kinds of things, and I ask them about their medical test results.
Mm-hmm.
And every time somebody talks to me about something, it means something to me.
Mm-hmm.
So if I ask somebody, do you bruise easily? And they say, yes, that means something. If they say no, then that means that issue isn't at the high priority.
Mm-hmm.
But if they bruise easily, all of a sudden, various kinds of nutritional information jumps to the top of the picture of what I would look at first.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, issues of, for example, what's your body temperature? Some people have never bothered to track it to know.
What is your
Other
body?
People will have
temperature.
Hands... cold hands and feet,
mm-hmm.
that they suffer from cold hands and feet all the time, and that they've been that way all their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never been diagnosed as a hypometabolic problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say at least half of the people who come to see me have that pre-existing condition
yes.
that's never been diagnosed.
Which means what, basically?
It means they're hypometabolic. Their metabolic rate is low, and they're at risk of cardiovascular disease and autoimmune diseases
mm-hmm.
and degenerative diseases.
And we don't know exactly why. We know why.
Their metabolism is too low.
Yeah, but we don't know why metabolism is low.
That's right. It could be heavy metals. It could be entrainment. It could be a thyroid problem.
Mm-hmm.
It could be an adrenal problem. It's truly massively complicated.
Okay.
And it's almost as complicated as the issue of if you have inflammation, what's causing it?
Mm-hmm.
Messy,
yeah. Okay.
Which is why doctors don't like it. It's just intrinsically a messy problem, and it requires them to become detectives. Mm-hmm. And doctors don't like that because
they don't have time
they have, you know, 5 to 15 minutes to deal with somebody,
exactly.
And it you can't be a detective in 5 to 15 minutes.
And then liability is also there. I mean, you might be a bad detective. Yeah?
That's true. And there's also the regulatory environment in which doctors work, where the standard of care is defined by what other doctors do,
mm-hmm.
not by what benefits you.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So if some doctor does something that benefits you that's not standard therapy,
mm-hmm.
they are at regulatory risk. They can be disciplined, and they can lose their license, and they can be fined.
Another question, very practical. Right now, there are a few laboratories where you can order your own test.
It's not just a few anymore. It's
massive.
It's widely opening.
Yeah,
yes.
But the problem is, like, as an ordinary person, I don't know all those names, all those tests which I need to do. Would you or can you suggest, say, okay, I need to, you know, to get started, I need this test, and we can go just get those tests by ourselves. We don't need to have our doctor to sign. So you know what these tests are about,
yeah.
And you can suggest those that are good, you know, for whatever purpose we came for.
So if you're a man and you're 45 to 55 years of age and you've got some kind of chronic health problem, first thing I suggest is, you know, have you had an iron workup?
Mm-hmm.
And because men accumulate iron from teenage years, and there's no reversal mechanism in the human body for offloading iron other than bleeding.
Mm.
And we don't do that anymore.
So basically you can just identify the fact and you have nothing to do with it.
Well, that particular issue is one that isn't assessed properly by the
mm-hmm.
medical profession.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of thing happens with thyroid tests.
Mm-hmm.
So you go in and you go get your thyroid test and they do a TSH and they say your TSH is 4.2, so you're fine. There's nothing wrong with your thyroid gland.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even though for you to have a normal metabolism, it needs to be 1.
Mm-hmm.
And you're at 4.5.
But how do we know
3.5.
What's my norm is?
Well, that's the issue, is that they don't know. It's like saying that the proper height for a human is somewhere between 1 foot and 10 feet.
Okay.
That's what they would consider. So if you're less than 1 foot tall, you're abnormal. If you're more than 10 feet tall, you're abnormal. That's not reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at people, you find that there's a sweet spot. And medical tests for thyroid don't find the sweet spot.
Okay.
So there is a way to find it, but it involves challenging yourself with thyroid hormone to see what happens. Now, if your metabolism is low and you have cold hands and feet
mm-hmm.
and your body temperature is 2 degrees below normal, you're at risk for infections, the flu, of dying from traumas, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But finding out what causes that is takes some degree of sleuthing. But it could just be a simple thyroid problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we have all these anti-thyroid influences in the world, and we're all encouraged to eat as much cruciferous vegetables as possible. Broccoli, kale, cauliflower, cabbage, all of those things lower your thyroid. We're encouraged to do all that. Then the question is, well, is it because you have too little thyroid? Well, what you can do is order your thyroid from overseas because you can't get it from a U.S. doctor, and just slowly ramp up your thyroid and watch what happens to your body temperature, your pulse rate, how well you feel, how well you sleep, your mental abilities, and look at that difference between your peripheral temperature and your core temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see that you're feeling better and your depression is going away and you're happier and your sex life is improving and all of these kinds of well-being measures,
mm-hmm.
Then you can say, I was hypothyroid.
Just a question of, since you mentioned the sexual life, and I know lots of men have an idea that they are supposed to be okay, let's say up to maybe 45, maybe 50, but after that it's not really the case. And what is the, I understand that, you know, average problem, but what is the normal age for being in a good shape with that for a man?
For sexual, for men,
yeah.
That they die from having sex. That's normal. In other words, that they have sex all the way up through their 80s and 90s and 100 years of age.
Okay.
That's normal.
So,
but it doesn't happen anymore. And so you find that, Viagra and other kinds of erectile dysfunction pills are become popular. And We have all kinds of herbal products that are sold for that thing, and virility is still considered an issue. But I mean, it's an issue of the male psyche, and it's not just a particular culture. You look at most of the cultures on the planet. Mm-hmm. Sexual virility is considered important in almost all of the societies.
So it is, let's say, if someone at age, God knows, 50, 55, 60, maybe even 70, has, I don't know, erection issues or attraction, you know, issues, so it is kind of curable or...
Yeah. Treatable.
Treatable, yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to say that that's curable because it's, on some level, it's really not a disease. Mm-hmm. But erectile function, that's well known, and the same... influence of nitric oxide on from Viagra, it can be done with herbs and can be done with foods. Mm-hmm. Like celery juice, for example, can give men erections that they if they've stopped. Mm-hmm. Issues of drive, competitiveness, assertiveness, territoriality, and things like that are driven by a dopamine neurotransmitter in the brain. And also influenced by testosterone. Mm-hmm. So if your testosterone to estrogen ratio, we start off men when we're young, let me do it this way, testosterone high, estrogen low, and as we age, they cross. So in old ages, men have higher estrogens than their postmenopausal wives, almost universally. That directly affects drive and sexual expression, even desire and fantasy. That's all correctable.
Okay. Yeah.
Practical question. So say, do you do any consulting?
You're going to have people asking questions about this for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
So I take Deprenil, which is a European Deprenil. It's one of the smart drugs. It's a dopaminergic agent, and it restores my dopamine to when I was, let's say, 35 or 40. So... you know, of two drugs I'm taking, of the 50 different things I'm taking, two of them are pharmaceuticals that I take on a regular basis. And Deprenil is one of them. And it has, as a side effect of raising sexuality and assertiveness and drives for getting stuff done, it also extends lifespan.
So, kind of, it has two good qualities.
Well, what is the bad quality then? Because it's a side effect.
You have to pay for it.
Oh, okay. So, and it doesn't do. What is the prime definition? What it's supposed to do? Because this, you said this is a side effect. So, what is it made for? What is made?
It's sold as a treatment for Parkinson's disease.
Oh, okay. Does it prevent people getting into Parkinson's eventually?
And it slows down the progression, whereas mainline therapy in the United States is Sinemet, and that accelerates the progression of Alzheimer's, of our Parkinson's disease.
So basically, if you take it early enough, you can prevent Parkinson's in all the stages. Huh?
Or at least decrease your likelihood. There are other factors that are very important in the development of Parkinson's disease, and exposure to certain kinds of toxins is one of them. And Deprenil really doesn't prevent that kind of toxicity from manifesting that way.
Yeah, and as a side effect, it improves your sexual life. Yeah.
Okay, so coming to practical, because you guys, you know, you're mad. It's your topic.
But women actually like Deprenil because it increases their assertiveness. Even though their sex drive isn't wired to dopamine like it is in men, women are much more selective about, you know, sex in their partners. The dopamine does deal with drive and assertiveness characteristics, which women do appreciate.
Say, for consultations, do you do any internet consultations through Skype, through some other internet sources? Say, like some of our viewers, say, located in the United States, I'm not talking right now those in Russia, because probably this is not affordable for them at all, but for those who are located in the United States, can you do, say, online consultation?
I do it all the time.
You do it all the time?
My clients are scattered all over the world.
So how much do you charge?
$250 an hour for the first hour, and then $150 after that. So if they have the stamina to do several hours, it ends up being more affordable. And it, each you know, because I focus on self-care technologies, which are about, you know, what you can do on your own and what you can learn on your own, and how you can go beyond the kinds of medical tests that you can get, which are focused on one-time testing, whereas self-care and biohacking testing is longitudinal testing. You're testing yourself over time. You can test your mind, you can test your heart rate, you can test sleep quality, you can test all kinds of things. And that is rapidly developing right now as sensors are becoming more and more sophisticated and they're getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper all the time. This is the age at which, you know, biometric testing is becoming the thing, and self-care testing is driving that market. And so this is a very, very powerful technology, and it's going to supplant medicine because there's a real limit to what you can get from biomarkers where a single reading isn't misleading. Things like blood sugar, which goes up and down. Testosterone in men not only has a daily cycle, it has every 6 hours it goes up and down as well. And so if you get tested at 10 a.m. and then later you get tested at 11:30 a.m., that difference could mean a 25% difference in your testosterone levels, which the doctors can't tell it has is from a random process instead of a therapeutic intervention. So there's all kinds of really cool stuff that's happening that way. So that's kind of what I teach. And so basically, once you learn how you can measure your mind and how you can measure your emotional state and how you can measure your heart rate and your body temperature, then it becomes your job to go off and measure it and track it over time. And that takes a long time. So a 1 or 2 hour conversation with me can lead to 2 months of focused effort.
Do you teach that in the books? You mentioned 5 books published on nutrition.
No.
Do you have any webinars for a group of people?
Well, I talk about this like here, and I talk about this on various podcasts and stuff. So I'm sharing it, and other people are also sharing this. Biohacking has become a kind of celebrity thing, and intermittent fasting has become, you know, a popular kind of thing. So the entire market, because of the influence of the internet, is spreading in that general direction. So it's out there, but I don't think I'm ever going to write another book. Books are just not the way to reach people.
But do you have a YouTube channel?
I have a YouTube channel. I blog on Quora. I have 2 other websites. I'm about to put my art on another website. So yes, that I think is the way to go nowadays, is putting stuff on YouTube and putting stuff on websites and you know, writing, instead of writing something as a masterpiece that's located in time, that becomes less and less useful over time, that you write things in chapters, and then as the chapters get out of date, you update them. So I have a book on viral disease that I've updated like 15 times since the first book that I've written. And it's just an online downloadable, you know, it's a book, but it's a free PDF download. And its content evolves as, you know, for example, when Ebola came out, all that information about, you know, what's involved in Ebola, how it's different than other viruses and how to treat it, that all was added to the book.
Yeah, this is cool. So do you have like a business card with all your links so we can put it underneath of our video?
No, I don't. I have, if you do it, if you type my name into a search engine, you're going to get 1,000 hits. So I'm, you know, I've been interviewed by most of the biohackers. I've been in documentaries. I've got several channels up there. So I do have a kind of file of links and stuff, but it's...
Make sure you have the exact spell of the name.
Yeah, because I don't have any information, you know, and, you know, we prefer something in writing.
Okay. Anna, I think we have to thank Steve for
the conversation. Educational, and I think that we may meet another time to talk about those supplements that I forgot at home.
Okay, that would be good. Yeah.